Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hello people, this is Ben. This is a small voice podcast featuring conversations with marvellous and interesting photographers talking about their lives and their work and their struggles to keep doing what they like doing whilst avoiding destitution. How's it going? Are we still all okay? Because there are hurricanes, the sky in London was just looking like something out of the new Blade Runner movie, and things are on fire, both literally and metaphorically. Don't you feel? It's stormy times. Thanks to those of you who got in touch to tell me you like the podcast. Always nice to hear from listeners. If you are a regular listener, please consider signing up for a small monthly recurring donation. Do also leave a review on iTunes. And if you or anyone else you know is in need of a new and improved website, do let me know at ben@bensmithphoto.com so that I may be of help in that regard using the Squarespace platform. I can build a website on any platform or from scratch, to be honest, but why would you? Squarespace should sponsor this blooming podcast, don't you feel? They sponsor most of the rest of them. Special rates apply for the next five websites, by the way. So it's episode 64, and on the podcast this week is Jenny Lewis. Jenny grew up in Essex in the southeast of England, went up north to Lancashire to take a degree in fine art at Preston University, and moved back south to London where she got a badly paid job at Metro, one of London's major photographic labs. It was here that her early photographic education began, spending all day producing and then examining hundreds of contact sheets from a diverse range of professional photographers. She also made the other kind of contacts within the London photo community, which allowed her to transition into assisting and eventually into becoming a jobbing editorial photographer, shooting mainly portraits for a variety of national newspapers and magazines. Alongside that work, which she continues to this day, Jenny pursues a range of personal work, much of which centres on her experience of living and working in the East London borough of Hackney, which has now been her beloved home for 20 years. Two of these personal projects have been published as books by Hoxton Mini Press. One Day Young captures mothers and their newborn babies within the first 24 hours of birth. And Hackney Studios, featuring environmental portraits of the network of creatives who live and work alongside her in the borough. One of Jenny's recent portraits, featuring Corinne, a survivor of the devastating Grenfell Tower fire, was selected for inclusion in the current nationwide exhibition Portrait of Britain. Incidentally, the Dana Luxembourg project that neither of us could remember the name of is, of course, Imperial Courts. There's a link to that in the show notes. I love talking to Jenny Lewis. Her passion and enthusiasm for photography and for her subjects and her projects is so palpable and so infectious. It's great to be around someone who loves what they do. You'll see what I mean. Here's my chat with Jenny. You grew up in Essex, didn't you? What kind of kid were you?
I don't know. Sporty, interested in stuff. Not particularly, well, sort of arty, but just, it's very difficult to be arty in Essex.
Yeah.
I don't think I went to a gallery till I was about 18, which I thought about a lot when I had kids, when I was like popping to the Tate once a week with them in the buggy. And I just thought, God, this is such a different cultural, the visual impact and stimulus and stuff they're absorbing, my kids are absorbing, is so different to what I would have seen growing up. Just, you know, we didn't have art books in the house.
Right.
We didn't go to galleries. We didn't, you know, there just wasn't that engagement in culture at all. Theatre or any, you know, anything, because it just wasn't around.
Yeah.
And it wasn't my parents, you know, their background.
So you had to sort of discover all that for yourself.
So I think I really discovered it for myself. And I mean, I can remember taking like art history and English for A-level, and suddenly my world totally opening up. Like art history, I found absolutely fascinating. And I could literally feel this film being pulled off my eyes. And suddenly I just couldn't walk down the street without looking at a building or looking at a chair design or just... It's like, how come I've never noticed this stuff before? And that really excited me.
Yeah, that must have felt amazing.
Well, that there was this whole other way of looking at things that I hadn't noticed or, you know, and a door had been opened and it just made life more interesting. Just getting on the train, going on the bus. Not that there was a lot of interesting stuff around Colchester, to be honest, but you started noticing things that you hadn't noticed otherwise. You started noticing just really nice light on the beach or something. You know, it's just like, why have I never noticed that light before? But I just hadn't been given the tools to look at things in a different way. So that was really exciting. So that's at 17, 18, I started to sort of wake up to stuff.
So did you have some inspirational teachers at doing art history?
That art history teacher, he was amazing. He was just, every penny he ever earned would go into a flight and he'd be back at some basilica or some church or some Renaissance thing or mannerist thing, and he'd come back and he'd just, you know, the language was just so imaginative and visual. It was really exciting to be taught by him.
That's amazing. The influence that one really inspirational teacher can have on your life is
hugely. I mean, if it had been just someone bored with their job,
yeah, you probably
could have been talking about the same stuff, but it just wouldn't have engaged my imagination in the same way. But he was just absolutely amazing, and not talking about modern art at all, you know, talking about Baroque architecture or something, but just that language was so exciting.
And it wasn't any particular, it was like there was a whole, so you were getting a whole kind of foundation in all types of art.
Nearly did art history as a degree rather than art. I was so kind of, yeah, I loved making and obviously wanted to be an artist. But I did find the history of art so interesting. Mm. I, you know, went and looked at art history courses as well as looking at art courses. Mm.
Yeah, but I think your boyfriend was doing photography, wasn't he? Is that how
it
started?
Oh, my God, where did you read that? I've spilled my guts too many times on interviews. Jesus.
No, you'd be surprised, maybe once or twice.
Yeah, that was at foundation course, and my boyfriend at the time had done photography. He was a year older and was going off to do a photography degree. So I sort of discovered photography, but felt like I couldn't do it because it felt like I'd be copying him, so I had to find my own way.
Right.
So I deliberately didn't do photography, although I could really feel it calling me. You know, I was a shit drawer, painter. You know, it wasn't something that came naturally to me. I loved visuals and storytelling and pictures, but I just felt I couldn't do photography because he was doing it. And I think that was almost the wrong decision. But then looking back, I'm actually really glad I did fine art, because I think it gave me a different approach to photography that a photography course would have given, possibly. I still have a little bit of, like, I've still got stuff to learn. You know, I'm always going to talks and lectures because I didn't do photography, and there must be more to learn. And those lecturers would have sent the students off to read this book and that book. So I try and fill in the gaps myself now.
Right.
But yeah, that's why I didn't do photography.
But has that influenced the way that you've shot as a photographer, do you think, or your style?
I think so. I mean, I didn't realise, but I think now that I've done so many interviews and talked about my work and the two book projects, I really think that looking at paintings and how to read paintings is has been absorbed somehow into my picture taking, or it's the way I read my own pictures.
Yeah.
Is that sort of, you know, looking at a Renaissance painting or... you know, when you might be looking at the quality of the fabric, oh, they must be in this sort of class, and the kind of, you start getting clues of someone's interior and you start to build up a picture of their life. So I quite like that sort of symbolism and the storytelling that you see in paintings.
Mm.
And it's how I would read a photo. So it has influenced things.
Yeah. Well, who was starting to influence you as far as photographers went at the beginning? You mentioned the Douglas.
Well, they weren't, to be honest. They weren't, because I had never studied photography.
Right, right, right.
I think I discovered the Douglas brothers, and I'd maybe written about them or... I discovered them when I was doing an essay about painting. And just weirdly, when I was working at Metro, they were using Metro, and I was like, oh my God, they're those people I wrote about. You know, it was like my heroes were coming in and out. And obviously their work is absolutely stunning and amazing. And those black and white shots were really painterly. The quality of the light, and
they didn't
seem like a flat photo. They felt really rich.
Yeah, I'm not really aware of them, funnily enough.
Really?
Which is interesting. Yeah.
I've got something at the National Portrait Gallery at the moment.
Okay. But I mean, I'm sure a lot of my listeners will.
But you know, I didn't know a lot about photography. I'd read about them and they came in and I was like, oh my God, it's the Douglas brothers. Amazing.
Yeah.
To be honest, they probably 20 years ago when I came, they split up and started working on film. So for the last 20 years, they haven't been photographers.
Right.
But it's their Cuba series, which I was particularly into.
Mm.
And lith prints and, you know, that really grainy
kind
of thing.
I'll have to check them out. You mentioned Metro, which is a big lab here in London, or was, back in the day when labs were a thing.
Yeah, Yeah.
I think they're still around, but not in the same capacity. But you worked there. So what brought you to doing that? Because I guess you did. Was there a plan as far as...
There was no plan, obviously no plan. But I finished my degree, which was up in Preston. And obviously, what do I do with a painting degree? I had no money. How was I going to get a job? So I worked... I was interested in photography a lot, so I... There was one lab in Preston, and I worked for them for the summer for 2 or 3 months. I think I got a fiver a week, 15 quid a week, just to like pay for some lunch. Anyway, did that for 2 or 3 months over the summer. I was probably on the dole to pay my rent. I can't remember. But then I saw an advert, just they had an industry magazine in the lab, and you know there was a job thing for a contact sheet printer at Metro. So I got the train down to London, went for the job interviews, you know, slept on my sister's sofa and got the job, started the next week. Right. I didn't have a house to live in. I didn't have, you know, money to get to work. I think I had cycled from Leytonstone because I couldn't literally afford the bus fare.
But your sister was living here in London?
Yeah. She was doing her MA or degree or something.
Okay.
So yeah, I just slept on her floor for a month till I had my first paycheck. And then ended up living with about 8 strangers in Leytonstone, including the Frank Chickens, who are a Japanese punk band,
really?
And lots of other random people in a house in Leytonstone.
Huh. You know. But so was it like working at the lab that made you start? Obviously, you're dealing with other people's pictures all day.
Oh God, it was like my apprenticeship, basically.
Did you look at the contact sheets that you were printing?
Of course.
Yeah,
like 300 a day.
Right.
Like, it was a machine. I was part of the machine.
But you looked at them with the eye of someone who was, interested.
Hugely interested. I was so excited. That job was so badly paid. And you worked like a dog. But I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I felt so alive and, like, in the thick of image making in London. I couldn't believe they were paying me to do it because I just loved it so much. But, yeah, hundreds of rolls a day. Of, you know, fashion photography, car photography, war photography, everything that was going on. And you'd contact it, you'd see the printers doing the prints later in the week, and then it'd be in the magazine at the weekend. And you were part of that process, and you saw it before everyone else.
Right,
and you started to understand, you know, what made a good picture just from seeing that huge contact sheet, which one was going to be picked. What, you know, you could see the weak ones and the strong ones, and you're judging everything. But to do 300 rolls a day, every day for 2 years, you learn a lot, you know.
I can see why that would be a great apprenticeship, because looking at contact sheets can be really instructive. And
some photographers, you know, every contact sheet was spot on. Absolutely spot on. And you could look at it and you could go, right, that's going to be 5 seconds at contrast 2, and they'd all be spot on. Some photographers, all over the place, completely shit. And then you realise that you could save it with beautiful printing. And almost that gave me confidence, as much as seeing the really amazing stuff, seeing how crap things could be and still look good, gave me this confidence that they're not amazing. They're not like 100% incredible photographers. It's all part of a process. It's the photography, the eye of the photographer, and then the skill of the printer, and even the skill of the picture editor choosing the really interesting image that someone else might have, you know, gone past.
No, that's really interesting.
It was such a fascinating apprenticeship.
Because like you say, you're seeing the stuff that no one normally sees, which is, you know, how terrible some people.
And really there's only one frame that's worked.
Yeah, but it works really well.
But it works perfectly and it tells the story, so it doesn't matter about the other stuff.
Yeah.
But you know, that was learning about 5.4, 120, 35 mils, different cameras, different film stocks, different chemicals. You know, I learned all the sort of hand processing as well as the machine stuff and all the different papers that people were printing with. At the time, Tom Stoddard had a massive show. I think it was at the South Bank on Bosnia. So that was all, you know, the rolls had come in and we'd processed them. And then, you know, all the prints were being made. And then we went to the opening. And it was just to be involved at that cut. You know, I never would have been invited to that show or known about it. But suddenly you're in the thick of everything. You could go to everything. You know, that's how I learned about photography, not through my painting degree, obviously. But yeah, later, just by like seeing what people were doing and absorbing it all and just being interested. And you could go up to the colour floor and see what was going on in colour as well. Although I was in black and white, you could just absorb everything that was happening. You know, that place was 24/7.
No, I can see that's a really interesting kind of apprenticeship that you had there. And also, you like you say, you're sort of, you're in the club kind of thing without really, you know.
And you didn't I didn't realise at all that you were in this world and you could ask anyone anything and that was okay, you know, photographers or as other assistants. And so many of those people are still pop up in my career, you know, like Steve McLeod.
Who's that?
You don't know Steve at Metro?
No.
Oh, amazing, right? He's just amazing. But he pops up everywhere.
Printer.
Printer. But, you know, he's so technical about all the processes and everything. But, he turns up everywhere. And just so many people and photographers that I met at the time coming in and out. And I see now. It's kind of like, there's a little old school crew.
Yeah.
Which is nice. It was nice to be part of something immediately. You know, you finish college and you're a bit lost. And this gave me a family and a creative family and people that were also interested in imagery and going to exhibitions and prints and talking about that in the pub afterwards. You know, it was just, that's all we talked about.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of people, and, you know, photographers of a certain generation and older talk with a lot of nostalgia about that whole period where you could, you know, you bump into each other at the lab and stuff, which of course doesn't happen anymore.
There was such a community. You know, you could, everyone would be getting their prints out and discussing them on the light box, and whether you were the new kid on the block or someone that printed there for 20 years, you could all be standing around discussing this image.
Yeah,
it was an amazing community. I really missed that because, you know, now you're working in quite an isolated way. So in a way, the sort of social media that I've really embraced and sharing things on Instagram, although you're not doing it face to face, you can get quite a lot of feedback and people are aware of your work and your projects as you're working on them, which is what you used to get as a one-to-one or face to face with your printer or photographers you met in the lab. But now you have it on social media and then you bump into people and they already know about your work. So you've already you've got a dialogue going, which I really enjoy that.
So you're of the sort of view that it's good to share stuff as you go along rather than sort of keeping it all under wraps.
Yeah, I think
being precious about it.
Until I did One Day Young, I was really precious and secretive and I think scared to share anything. Always a bit someone's going to nick that idea and that's just not really very helpful. Or maybe you just get more confident as you're going along and you just think, oh, sod it, you know. Let it out there. But no, I share everything as I go along. Nothing, I can't sit on anything. It's just always shared too early, overshared. But I like that rapport with people and, you know, it's not elitist, is it, on social media? Anyone can talk to you. You know, students will message and say things and, you know, other photographers. I think Harry Borden called me up because he saw something. We started tweeting, you know.
Yeah, it's really
about
nice
something because he
happens.
Had his dad project and obviously One Day Young and then he was like, oh, I'll just give you a call. So that wouldn't have happened before because you'd just feel really weird ringing someone up. But if you've already had a bit of a conversation on social media, then you can go up to someone at a exhibition and go, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because you've already started talking.
Yeah, totally.
It breaks the ice.
That's happened to me a lot with this podcast especially, which, you know,
I like how the elitism, because you can see there's such a sort of, there is a bit of an old boys club with photography.
Totally.
And there's quite a hierarchy. And I think social media sort of breaks down that elitism. Mm. And, you know, anyone can talk to anyone and it feels friendly, which is nice.
So how did you, was there a big break as such? Because obviously at some point you had to break free of the, because, you know, some people disappear into that, you know, take a kind of salaried job and never manage to escape it again.
I don't think
you
it paid very well, so it wasn't hard to let go.
Okay,
off.
So it was reasonably easy to let go.
You know, I got a great experience from it, and it was a really good way to move into assisting because I'd met so many photographers that, like the Douglas brothers, were the first people I assisted, and I adored their work. I was not qualified enough to assist them, but blagged it. But yeah, it gave me that introduction. But also because Metro was 24/7, I could start assisting and process and do film at night. They were like really supportive and they'd give you like 3 days, you could work a weekend or 3 days in the evening or cover someone when they're off. So that was my transition into assisting. So it wasn't that difficult because I wasn't taking a drop in salary. I was assisting and still being able to get a bit of work there, but also be able to go in and process my own stuff, because I would never have been able to shoot on film and process it for like a little Kerrang job or NME or Dazed or whatever, you know. By working in a lab, it facilitated me being able to afford to process the film and do my own prints.
Yeah, no,
I just don't know how I would have done it otherwise.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
It was so expensive, you know, to leave and try and make a portfolio. But because I could print and I knew all the printers and everyone would do each other favours, that made it possible.
Yeah, of course.
But yeah, God, it was so expensive, everything being on film.
Yeah, and there's a kind of, a lot of people are, I think, particularly the sort of digital natives generation and now seem to be quite enthusiastic about film. A lot of them are anyway. So they've also got, you know, it's funny that now that they don't have to find, you know, they've got a choice not to do that. And
yeah,
by shooting digitally,
yeah.
They're choosing to,
yeah.
And figuring out somehow how to pay for it,
yeah.
Pay for all that processing.
I find it amazing because I definitely wouldn't have been able to afford, there's no way I could have done One Day Young on film, shoot 150 people and buy all that film and process it and print it, you know. I wouldn't have been able to do a film with that kind of longevity without digital.
Mm.
So it really gave me that freedom.
Yeah, yeah, no.
You know, I've always been a photographer that has to earn money.
Well, yeah,
so,
like most
people. Well, you say like most, I'm not sure if that's really the case.
What,
but
you mean some people have got some other means?
Well, how do people survive shooting loads of film for editorial, which editorial doesn't have the budget for it? I mean, how does that work?
I don't know.
So, you know, I've always had to assist or work in the lab or work in a pub. And it's got to pay its way. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah.
It took me a long time to do a personal project because photography had to pay the rent.
Right.
So, you know, I had to do editorial jobs and keep to that two roles.
Yeah. Did you have ideas for personal projects which were sort of on the back burner that you couldn't do because of that? Or was One Day Young the sort of first?
I was trying to think about this. I mean, I did. I'm not sure that I did. I think I had such an sort of work ethic that I had to prove that this was a job that
right.
paid and I could survive on it, you know, because I didn't come from that sort of background. So to do an art degree and then sort of waft into photography, that wasn't going to be an option. It had to be a jobbing photographer and make it work. So there wasn't that much space for personal projects. You know, I felt like quite a luxury, and I also kind of felt like, well, what did I have to say about anything that anyone would be interested in? I didn't feel in that sort of position until a lot later.
Who did you start working for editorially? Was there any big break as far as doing the editorial stuff? And
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
was it always going to be portraits for you?
Yeah, well, I assisted quite a lot of people after I left Metro, and it was when I assisted Polly Borland, who's a portrait photographer, that I get, like when I said I moved to Hackney and it just clicked, like this was the right space for me. When I started working for Polly and she's a portrait photographer, it just clicked that this really suited me. This is what I really enjoyed, the sort of one-to-one conversation with somebody, trying to figure them out and get a portrait of them really suited me more than the big team and the concept of like a fashion shoot or all the people coming along to a music shoot and having to get 13 shots of this band in a day to sell their record. You know, it just, I like the intimacy of a portrait. So, but yeah, quite quickly I understood that was my thing that I enjoyed.
What were some of the early commissions as far as portraits go? Do you remember some of those?
Yeah, I mean,
first ones.
I used to do quite a lot for Saturday Times. And quite early on, Lindsay commissioned me to do Keira Knightley. And it was for a front cover. And it was quite early on, so it was like, really? But it was just brilliant. I was actually doing a personal project at the time, which was girls in their bedrooms. I just wanted, you know, something easy that I could do, and I could relate to these girls because they were sort of same age as me. And actually doing Keira, she wasn't that much younger than me. You know, it was just, it felt really intimate, and it felt okay to have her sitting on a bed.
Yeah.
And I probably got a very different picture than if it had been an older male photographer.
Yeah, I was thinking that.
It would have felt very different. So
yeah.
That just felt like,
Keira, can you just come and lie on the bed? You know?
And it would have been a bit lechy and a bit weird. Mm. But because I was asking her and we were just having a chat and we could relate to each other, I think her mum was there as well. We just had a really nice afternoon, and it was part of a press junket, and they're usually quite sort of, right, you've got 10 minutes in, out, but we were like just chilling out, having a cup of tea,
yeah,
chatting, and she was really relaxed, and that's great because that gave me a great cover, and that was the first cover I did, I think,
right,
for the Times. And I realised I had something that maybe all those other photographers who were more established didn't have, because they wouldn't have been able to relate to her in the same way. So you start to understand that it's, you have got something to give. You know, you've got to wait for the right job, you know. I wouldn't have been right to do like a, maybe an older male politician or something, but, you know, jobs started to come which would work well for me. And I think that was quite a big risk for them to send me on that.
For a cover, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then there are lots of examples of that sort of someone taking the chance on you, because ultimately everyone has
risk
to...
For them, like, looking back, it's quite a risk for them because they've, you know, it's a weekly magazine. It's got to be good.
Yeah.
It's a celebrity. You might not have very long. So yeah. It's a big risk for those picture editors when they try someone new, I think.
Worked out, though.
Yeah, I really appreciate that.
But, and you've, I think you've sort of said you don't even really use an assistant yourself for those kind of, I mean, kind of, you know, portrait. Is there something about...
Now I don't.
Right, but then you...
That's come through confidence, through doing One Day Young and Hackney Studio. I couldn't have an assistant. I couldn't have lights because it was just me. I didn't have the money. So doing those two projects over the last 10 years, my whole practice has got simpler and simpler and simpler. And now that feeds back into the way I prefer working. So now on those sort of editorial jobs, I will try and do it on my own without someone from the magazine coming down, maybe without the writer, and really just try and keep to that sort of one-on-one conversation and that intimacy.
Yeah.
If I can.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you need to go somewhere and you've got 10 minutes... with a celebrity and you don't know if there's going to be daylight in the room, of course I take an assistant and lights and what have you. But
I used to do that. So I used to do that when I used to do stuff at the Sunday Times quite regularly. I never took an assistant. I didn't even know that was an option, really. Do you know what I mean? I was so
take assistant.
Yeah, like I was so green.
I think because I'd been an assistant and been on so many jobs,
you knew
like
how it
that,
worked. Yeah,
I could see how it worked and expected the same. You know. Although probably got paid a bit less. But I knew that that was the deal, you know. And that was such a good training, being an assistant to a portrait photographer. And, you know, with Polly, we did The Queen. And
I was
going to
say.
Nick Cave, and we did, you know, we did everyone for a couple of years. Show for the National Portrait Gallery. So I'd been on hundreds and hundreds of portrait shoots, and I could see how it worked.
Even shooting The Queen, which is, you know, by any standards,
well, it's
is pretty weird.
It's a different... thing, but you can see, you know, even within 5 minutes you can make it work if you're organized.
Yeah, good experience.
And you can still make it your own photo, you know. Polly could still make that her own photo, even though, you know, the situation is really limited when you're photographing someone like that.
We should talk about One Day Young, because we have mentioned it quite a lot, and obviously it was your first big personal project, as you said, and it became a book, which was published by Hoxton Mini Press. One Day Young is a series of portraits of women with their newborns, all shot within 24 hours of birth. So how did that first come about?
I think work had started to slow down after I had my kids. So Ruby was 2.5. I probably started it when Herb was 6 months. 6 months old. So work had actually slowed down, but I was still making it work in between looking after the kids. And I don't know. I think actually by having less work, it gave me more creative space to think about what I wanted to do. Whereas I hadn't had time to think about it before. It was just like one job led to a job, and then you're trying to get more work, and the weeks, months, years go on. And I hadn't actually stopped to think, hadn't had the breathing space. So I was kind of furious in a way. You know, people sort of see the project and think it's really soft and really lovely. And actually it came out of pure anger that I was like, really furious that I didn't realize that having a baby would be the most empowering physical thing I could ever do. And what I'd approached motherhood and birth with was fear and negativity, and it's going to be so painful, and it's going to be so awful, and it's going to change your life, you'll never be the same again, all these kind of negative messages. And actually I felt more empowered, you know, on the day of the birth, and subsequently I felt like I could connect with people more. And I was just really furious about it. And I didn't know how to express it apart from maybe making some images about this rather than keep going up to people at bus stops and going, it's going to be okay, you're going to be fine. You know, I was like talking to strangers, trying to reassure people because I didn't feel like I got the reassurance.
So you felt that the messages that women get about birth specifically, not about becoming a mum, but just about the process of actually giving
birth.
Are very sort of a kind of scaremongering and
I think really unhelpful.
And unhelpful, yeah.
And it's kind of like, it doesn't, why would you give an unhelpful vibe and message when actually it can be really empowering? So why not give that message and give people some hope and some confidence? And if people have more of those stories and those voices in their head, it's more likely that they will be okay because they haven't got that seed of fear brewing and waiting to grow. They've got this seed of confidence. So I just wanted to implant that into a few people because I wish someone had done it to me. So I really thought I'd do 10 images and show this and approach the Guardian or somebody and see if I could get a feature on this sort of a different imagery for birth rather than, you know, I think one born every minute had started and I hadn't even watched it, but just the thought of sensationalizing birth and putting more fear into women was making me really mad. You know, I was like, oh, here we go again. You know,
featured various births, yeah.
Well, it was like, not only have we got images in magazines and the way birth is talked about is really negative, we've now got a TV program to just put all this fear in women. It's like, what the hell is going on? What's wrong with people? But anyway, yeah, so I started, did 10. Some of the women I met were just so incredible and their stories that they told me just gave me this feeling of responsibility to them that it had to be more than just a throwaway feature and I needed to meet more people and tell more stories and listen to these people and put them on a pedestal and go, you know, look at this, they're amazing. Why are they being ignored?
Well, can you share a couple of those stories then of ones that are sort of stuck in your mind particularly?
There was one really early on. It might have been like the fourth woman. And I didn't know any of these women. So it's kind of quite an unusual position to be invited into a stranger's house the day they've had a baby and them just opening up about their experience and letting you into their home. And it really changed my view of humanity and strangers and how you can connect with people that you've never met before quite intimately. But Jyoti was an incredible woman. And while I was photographing her, I noticed there was kids' toys around. So I was like, oh, obviously this is your second child. And she was like, actually, it's my third. I lost one a year ago in childbirth. And then she told me about losing Joseph and how every contraction she'd just been through was a balance of squashing the fear that she was going to lose this child and sort of overcoming that fear to get through the contraction and onto the next. And she was standing there telling me this with a 4-hour-old baby. And it had just happened and he was bright red and he was healthy and he was like 10.5 pounds. He was massive. And it was just such an incredible conversation talking about life and death and loss and grief. You know, massive conversation. It gives me goosebumps even thinking about it now because it was the sort of conversation I'd never had with my mum, I'd never had with a friend, but this complete stranger was just talking to me. And with a camera, you feel like you can keep asking questions, whereas if you didn't have the camera there, you might not ask and you might not push to keep the conversation going. But somehow with the camera there, you've got this different reason for being in the room. So it allows you to investigate not only the image in front of you, but by conversation and talking, you can delve, like you're delving with the microphone, you're probably asking things you wouldn't ask if we were just met at an exhibition or something. So that the tool of the camera allows you to investigate deeper and a bit further. But yeah, I felt like when I left, I mean, I got in the car and I was just weeping. I couldn't believe what this woman had gone through. You know, I just felt like she was so powerful and strong to have managed to do that a year later and have a home birth because she was scared to go into hospital. So she'd literally just given birth in the lounge where we were taking the picture. But yeah, I left there with this feeling of there's 100 more women like that out there and no one knows their story and what they've been through and how strong and powerful they are. And if she can do this and triumph over this physical challenge with the idea of her son that had died in her head, then, you know, why isn't she being celebrated? You know, if she can do this, we can all do this. And I just thought that was the sort of stories that ought to be told.
That's great. So you went quite old school in trying to find your subjects because you did some leafleting.
I didn't know how to find people. I mean, I didn't really know anyone who was pregnant or having, you know, I didn't know how to find people. I wasn't allowed to put posters up. Obviously, you'd think you'd go to the maternity hospital in Homerton, but I wasn't allowed to put posters up in there because I was asking to go into people's houses and they didn't know me. And I was, you know, there's no way they'd let me. And same with doctor's surgeries and nurseries and schools. So I didn't know how to find people. To be honest, I didn't know anything about social media at that point either. So I didn't have Twitter and Instagram, let alone a following on those platforms. So I just thought, I'll just stick up some leaflets in the park, you know. And my husband was like, no one's going to call you. Why would anyone let a stranger in the house at that time? Everyone thought I was nuts. But then I started getting emails from strangers. And once then another one would come in. I was like, it might work. So by the time I got 10 and actually did their photos, then I had a gallery I could put up on my website. So then the next leaflets would have an image on so they could see what they would get. And there was a link to a website so they could start to see a gallery. So they become... they could start to trust me that this is the kind of thing that they would get. But, you know, it did take a while. It took 5 years.
Yeah.
It's not like it was a three-month project and suddenly I had lists of people to work with. But I did have a really nice graphic in my office, which was all these coloured post-it notes, which became this huge grid on the wall of name, address and due date of complete strangers. Because I knew I had to be quite quick if I got the text saying... I'm back at home, it might already be 20 hours and I wasn't going to photograph anyone over 24 hours. So I'd have to grab the post-it note and get on my bike. And that I had all the information I needed there, their address and, you know, just get there. So that was really nice. Mm. But I didn't want to know what people looked like. I didn't want to treat it like a fashion shoot and cast people and go, right, I need someone like that and someone like that. So anyone who emailed me, I agreed to do. I didn't know what anyone looked like, which made it really exciting for me because I'd get to the door not having a clue whether it was a 20-year-old, a 40-year-old, anything about them. And then we'd just have this really intense conversation for an hour while I was photographing and then I'd be gone. And it was just, yeah, it was really exciting working like that.
Did it become a bit obsessive in a way?
Yeah, I mean, very.
It did?
Yeah.
Because you were just enjoying that process.
I really felt like I was getting somewhere. I mean, the pictures are quite repetitive. You know, it is mostly like a torso shot of the woman. And I quite quickly found out what sort of worked, you know, rather than being crumpled up in a chair. Like quite a lot of them, they're standing. You know, it's in a way, it's me manipulating the image because it just gave them a bit more strength to be standing. And depending how I edited it, there's obviously ones of them laughing and looking down at the baby. In fact, it was hard to get them to look at the camera because there's this magnetic pull to look at the baby. But then if I'd chosen all of them, it's quite sort of that traditional mother and child looking down and more about the baby. And I wanted it to be more about the woman. So the way I edited it, it's quite a lot of confrontational gaze with the camera and they're looking straight out the picture at you. And it just, you know, so I'm adding strength and what I'm trying to get out of the picture in the editing process.
Yeah, of course. That woman on the cover of the book, yeah, that was quite an early... Yeah, was that one of the early ones? Because wasn't that the picture you put on the leaflet?
Well, I kept changing the leaflets.
You changed it, okay.
So she was... There's one which is in the book of her really laughing.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
Obviously that's a really engaging photo and it make people feel safe. So that was a really good one to put on the leaflet.
Yeah, because she looks really, really happy. And
so... That's just going to draw people into the leaflet and then they can look at the website and then they can see more. But I kept changing the image because obviously I wanted to relate to all women. So I couldn't just have a white woman on the cover and then I'd have an Asian woman on the cover. Then, and I'd change the ages and just keep changing. I mean, I was putting the posters up a lot every couple of months because they'd get covered up with everything else. So I could quite quickly change it and make it more relevant. And then, you know, that community might recognize that woman on Chatsworth Road. So I'd put, you know, an image of someone who lived near there on there. So that's her community. And if I did one in Stokey, I might choose someone who'd lived up there. So just to sort of try and draw people in that it was something safe and something nice to be involved in.
So when you kind of came to do the book and make an edit, it was like, I think there's 40 pictures or something. Was it difficult? What were the criteria? Was it just the pictures you liked the most? Was it partly to do with the stories?
When I saw Hoxton Mini Press, I had over 100 already. But you know which ones are really strong. And you just can't, you know, there's something about that woman or the way she's engaging with you. You just can't, there's no way you can take her out of the edit. So, you know, I'd have them stuck on the wall. But then you'd realise that you had two very similar backgrounds. So they're sort of culturally the same sort of woman. So do we need to repeat this and then maybe get rid of one? Or even things like people looking left and looking right. You know, to do a book edit is very different from, say, a magazine, not a magazine, exhibition edit, or even on the website gallery. For a book, it's a different object, so you've got to make it flow through the book and make it work like that. So plain backgrounds, really patterned backgrounds, different ages, different cultures, and just get that diversity in. Because really I just wanted to relate to as wide, and you know, the whole thing is motherhood is a very leveling experience, and you just feel that you can suddenly relate to all women who are mothers. So that had to be represented in the book. You know, this is for everyone.
Well, your sort of final challenge was to find a teenage mum, because you wanted, that was important for you, and you just about managed that.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't have published that series without having a teenage mum. To me, it was screaming at me, because I was so aware that there was this gap and this invisibility of young mothers, which, you know, I mean, maybe no one else would have noticed, but to me, it just felt so judgmental that it'll be, you know, this is a really empowering series if you're over 22.
Right.
And that isn't what I was trying to say at all. So it was really important for me that I had to find a teenage mum, which was quite a struggle. Because the more vulnerable mothers, you know, I photographed people who are 14, 15, but they had to stay in hospital for a week. And I had to stick to the 24 hours. It had to be within the first 24 hours, or otherwise it wouldn't have made sense, really.
Yeah. So you just about managed to find someone. I think after you'd already, it was the last...
The edit moment needed to be in that day, pretty much. Yeah. And then Xanthi's mum called, and she was incredible. I mean, not only, because not every picture is going to be brilliant, but I knew that I was going to have to put in this teenage mum, whether the picture was a bit weak or not. But then I got to their house, and Xanthi's absolutely amazing looking, long red hair, pre-Raphaelite, really pale, transparent skin. And absolutely glowing and so confident. You know, she was 17. And as I was photographing her, I was sort of imagining my 17-year-old self and what a mess I was. And just, I just couldn't imagine being the image that I was seeing in front of me, of this like pride and confidence and so at ease with herself and at ease with the baby. I was, you know, it was a really brilliant moment to capture. And so nice to be able to portray a teenage mother in that way, as a valiant, you know, the triumph over birth and the challenges of birth in a young mother. You know, so often you see, you know, the young mother in a hostel and struggling.
Yeah, because I mean, so often they're not going to be in a stable relationship, or they're not necessarily, yeah. I don't know about Xanthi personally, but you know, you expect there's a
certain
cliche.
But even the women, I mean, a lot of the women that I photographed, the partner had already left by the time I was photographing them. But still, they are so strong and empowered and triumphant. And this is the point, you know, it's not about the stability of the relationship, the stability of their life. And you see so many different backgrounds and maybe struggles that are going on. But in that moment, they're so proud of themselves and protective of the baby that reality is kind of like pushed away. It's just the primitive survival technique coming in.
So the book's done really well. How many have they sold? Because I think it's been reprinted a couple of times.
Literally last week, Hoxton Mini Press told me that they were on the second print of the second edition. I'm not quite sure what, you know, what all the terms are, but it's like over 6,000 now.
Is that surprising to you? Is that overshooting? Well, I mean,
it was a tiny project. I'd never done a book before, so you know, I don't really know the numbers for photography books. But having since spoken to people, you know, people are like, really? They printed 2,700 on the first print run. You know, photography books are usually 500, and I had no idea. To me, that was just a number. I didn't know anything about publishing, so It is quite a lot, apparently.
Yeah, it is a lot, I think. And I wonder what it is about it that that attracts people. Have you thought about that at all?
Obviously, it's just the brilliant photography, I
presume.
Yeah,
the quality of the pictures.
I think it's with the perfect publisher for that project. I think Martin's really clever and knows what he's... brand is about, and I didn't want it to be a really expensive photography coffee table book. I wanted to get my main goal was to get this message of empowering women to as many people as I could, not just photography fans, but to a really diverse audience. And I think Hoxton Mini Press do that because they're not just photography books, they are gift books as well. You know, the price makes it affordable. It's like $12.95. It's not like a £30 book.
Yeah,
it's a small gift book. So it might have a big, powerful, strong message, but it's packaged in a way that makes it very, I don't know, what's
accessible.
The word? Accessible, yeah. Which I think is really important, and I love that. I love seeing it, you know, I love seeing it in the Tate and the Photographer's Gallery, but I also love seeing it in Waterstones or like a gift shop. It's, you know, you're reaching so many different types of people. That's really exciting.
Yeah, no, Hoxton Mini Press seem to be brilliant at that, kind of getting that kind of distribution to sort of mainstream, you know, outlets. And I think, you know, obviously it's multifactorial. In a way, it was kind of a stupid question, but because there is no one answer, obviously. But I was just wondering about, because, you know, at one point, I think a curator said to you, you know, you're not probably going to get much interest as far as getting this exhibited goes because people aren't interested. And I wonder why she thought that people wouldn't be interested in
that. Well, that was Susan Bright. And so she's got a good... She knows what she's talking about. And, you know, she'd just done the Home Truths exhibition. So while I was photographing this series, before she did the Home Truths exhibition, I sent her some of the images. And, you know, the whole reason she did the Home Truths exhibition was because images of motherhood are never seen in a gallery context. So she really had to fight for that. So she was just warning me that, you know, the work's really important and brilliant, but you'll really struggle to get it into a gallery, which, you know, I still am struggling. I haven't got it into a gallery. I'd love it as an exhibition. And that was, as much as I was annoyed at the time that motherhood and birth wasn't in the media in a positive light, I was obviously also hugely annoyed that it wasn't a topic of art. It wasn't a topic of photography. People really shy away from it because they don't, you know, I don't know whether a female photographers don't want to be associated with being branded like motherhood and that kind of topic. It's maybe not cool, and it's just not a topic for art. It doesn't seem to have been for a long time.
Interesting. So, yeah, so she's talking very specifically about as an exhibition, and that, you know, the success of the book is no indication, as it were.
No, is it accepted into the art world? I don't know. Oh, yeah. I mean, I like I say, I'm really excited that it's in... those bookshops like the Photographer's Gallery and the Tate. It feels like, okay, this is the audience I also want to be reaching. But will it ever reach inside an exhibition space? Will it be accepted into that kind of thing? I'm not sure. I'd hope so. But I think it's difficult.
Let's talk about Hackney Studios a little bit, because that was your next book project. Also, Hoxton Mini Press published it. And it's people in their workspaces here in Hackney, which I think we've already hopefully introduced as a kind of theme and as a place. You were saying you were kind of, it was partly because you just wanted a studio. You were kind of, or did you have one?
Talking about that community that I had when I was in Metro and how photography had changed, and then having kids, and it makes, you know, your time is... Well, you have no time, but it's very isolating. So I've got an office in the spare room at home. So I don't interact with other people unless I'm actually on a shoot. And I was just really curious and maybe a bit jealous of all these people that had this network of, you know, in their studios and people to bounce ideas off. So I was interested in looking in at that and figuring out whether it's something maybe I didn't feel a part of and I wanted to be a part of and I didn't know how to get in. But also because all these strangers had let me in their houses for One Day Young, I thought it's not going to be that hard to get into people's workspaces because, you know, I don't have to kind of wait for the contractions and then fly in and out. And it's so hard
to do a
project like that.
You've already done something more difficult.
This would be like really easy to set up and like meet you on a Monday afternoon, you know, unless you get get work. I can just do it. And I just felt so much simpler. But I didn't even intend to do it as a project. It actually just started. I saw someone who was interesting, asked to photograph them in their studio. And I had such a nice afternoon because we could have that conversation about Hackney and being creatives and how does it work for you. And we were just having, you know, we could engage with each other very easily. So I just had a really nice time and said, you know, who would you suggest that I could go and photograph? Just someone interesting, just to do as a nice thing to do. You know, why wait for someone interesting to photograph from a commission? Why not just get on and do it anyway? So it was just something I wanted to do. And then just one led to the next. And it wasn't till I'd done about 10 that I thought, oh, this is actually becoming something. This is becoming this sort of family tree of creatives and who they admire and their mentors. And it's starting to feel like something. And it's got its own energy and it's controlling me because it was sending me on the next thing. I wasn't asking for anything. It was all just started to happen. And I had the family tree written up in my office and I could see it branching off to like two or three people. And then there'd be three threads running at once. And it was just really exciting, engaging conversations, talking to people about stuff I was also going through, you know, just giving me that community that I wanted. But not even having a studio, but having those conversations about how do you, you know, what's going on with budgets? How do you find that? Or
so it's that thing of really just using the photography as an excuse to, absolutely, you know, engage, yeah, in a, yeah, world that you,
yeah, which it gets you in the door, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to meet these people anyway, but I can just go knock on the door and have a conversation and be a mad person.
Yeah.
But with a camera, it got me in the door, got me having a conversation. And then they'd introduce me to the most interesting person they could think of. So each conversation was brilliant. You know, it wasn't just like, oh, they're all right, go and see them. You know, it's like choose one person you think's amazing. Mm. You're going to come up with someone pretty good.
Yeah.
So,
but as you say, you think, but that's a key decision, I think, for you to have decided that everyone was going to suggest the next person kind of thing.
Well, I didn't want that arrogance. I didn't want to feel like a Guardian journalist coming up with, these are the 50 interesting people in Hackney, because I say they are. Yeah, right. And they're sort of a bit nepotistic and they're sort of my mates and it's a bit weak and pathetic. Mm. And we all know them anyway. So by each person suggesting someone, I had no control over where it was going. And that made it really exciting because, I mean, sometimes I'd know the artist, but not know them personally, but I'd know their work. Sometimes I'd never heard of them. So it's like, it's nice to be able to research someone, find out about their work. The next day you're in their space surrounded by their work. And it's, you know, with an artist studio, it's like their head's exploded and it's splattered all over the walls and you can see their work in process. And then they're explaining it to you. And then, you know, you've now made a connection with them because their friends suggested them and then they lead you to the next one. And before you know it, you're meeting at a, you know, an event they might have put on and you know three people in the room where you didn't know any of them before. Mm. So it was just like really, really lovely way to work.
Mm. It got quite a lot of response in the States, is that right? In terms of sort of social media or going... Oh,
that was One Day Young.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Hackney Studios.
No, when I was, well, that blog I was talking about at the talk the other night, that was One Day Young. So One Day Young had... That's when I started to realise the power of social media. So One Day Young had a blog written about it, and within a week it had 35,000 shares. And then it went sort of global, and I was getting requests from Brazil and Israel and China and, you know.
Yeah, no, that makes more sense because obviously it's very universal, yeah, you know.
And that's before I got the publishing deal. So then I could go to Hoxton Mini Press and give them these stats and these figures, and it's like... Not only could I persuade them with the pictures, you know, did they like the pictures, but they could see the effect it was having and people were really interested globally.
Because the thing, what occurred to me about Hackney Studios thing is it's pretty parochial. I mean, you know, if you do live in, you know, Kansas City, you don't, you know, it doesn't going to mean anything
to
you.
Well, also, if you live in Bradford, is it going to mean anything to you?
Precisely.
If you, you know, it's a very local project about, and it's very specific to this area and what's going on, but actually you can see that the same thing is going on in Brooklyn, you can see the same thing is going on in Berlin. It's kind of a commentary of the aggressive way cities kind of bulldoze through areas and money and change, and you can't stop it, and it happens everywhere. Although this is just showing this pocket of what's going on here, it kind of does happen everywhere.
Yeah, I think
so. It has got universal themes, but it is very much a historical document of what's going on in this community. And, you know, it started as a celebration and, looking into networks and how creatives work. But very quickly, all the discussions I was having were about studios being bulldozed, gentrification, not being able to work in the area. An artist would say, you know, I can stay here because I'm established, but my assistants can't live anywhere near. So how is this going to work if they've got to travel in for a couple of hours? Mm. And they used to be like being able to live next door, and then you'd have that community of the assistants and the established artist and everyone living together. And that's really changing as people are moving out. I mean, by the time Hankney Studios was published, about a third of the people had to move out. So it becomes a very different thing. And now, 6 months later, after it's come out, I would think half the people have moved out. I mean, it's happening so quickly. Mm. In a couple of years, possibly.
Yeah, it will all be different.
It's a vague memory of what used to go on in this area. So it becomes quite sad.
Mm.
And there's quite a sort of sense of loss.
And the book becomes, you know, in a way more important because
it becomes poignant. It's, you
a
know,
little
it's,
snapshot.
It's not exactly the steel industry closing, but it's still someone's community being destroyed out of their control. And it's my story. It's my community. So although, you know, does anyone else give a shit about it? I do. So I want to document it. And it means a lot to me. So, I mean, you can't really work on stuff unless it means a lot to you.
Do you think that's true?
Well, I can't.
Mm.
Because look at the time it takes. Both projects have taken 5 years.
Yeah.
It's not something you earn any money off. If you don't love it and if it doesn't mean a hell of a lot to you, why would you do it?
Well,
what
I was
have you got
say,
to say about it?
Is that your main piece of advice for people, you know, thinking of embarking on long-term projects? What have you kind of learned from doing them? What tips would you pass on?
I wouldn't do another long-term project, well, like these two, unless I couldn't not do it.
Right, it has to be.
I would play with the idea for a bit and I would just be like, I wouldn't even endeavour going down that road unless I couldn't leave it alone.
Because that has to carry you through, you know.
Because it's a huge amount of work.
Yeah.
And you've got to really care to keep going and to delve deeper and deeper and deeper.
I think I'm having that problem at the moment.
And what is the point if it's not a subject that you feel passionately about? And both those projects I couldn't not do, and I didn't know how else to get them out of my head. And I couldn't do anything else because that's all I was thinking about. So, but they do take over, my God. Mm. So then it's hard to have the energy and time to do the other work you should be doing, your paid work, your day-to-day work. You know, these projects start becoming everything. It's all you can think about. So finding that balance is pretty
difficult.
I'm struggling with that. Mm. So I'm really trying not to like jump onto the next one because I know I just find it so overwhelming.
Do you have anything in mind?
A couple of things, but God, I'm always scared to say it because then I'll bloody do it.
Then you have to do it.
But yeah, there's ideas wafting around in my head, and I've almost started like reaching out to people and researching. But I'm sort of trying to really slow it down because I don't want to leap into something, and I also want to give those other projects a bit of time to breathe. You start learning so much about them when you're giving talks. You know, that photo forum talk last night. Things came up in that talk I hadn't even thought about. And I always find when I'm giving a lecture or a talk about the projects, you start to understand them more. I mean, I understand One Day Young so much more because I've talked about it for 2 years and done so many interviews. And I'm still discovering things about Hackney Studios. At that talk, I don't know how it came up, but I was suddenly explaining that you manipulate the person depending on what conversation you're having, and that changes their body language and the mood and even just the sort of eye contact. And I hadn't even thought about that before. And then, you know, it made me learn something from my own process. And then, you know, the shoot that I've got to do next week, I'll be thinking, well, I really need to watch what kind of conversation and how I lead the conversation because it will change.
Yeah, so you learn
body
things
language.
After
and
the
so
fact.
You're constantly learning stuff and like, you know, did I manipulate all of them or was One Day Young so celebratory? Because that was the conversation I was having with them. They'd just had a baby. But then you've got a variety of conversations with Hackney Studio, but a lot of them were about this gentrification. So was I putting on this? Was I leading them down this quite solemn conversation? And then you get that mood in the pictures. If I'd avoided that conversation, would I have got a different
thing?
Point. So I feel like I'm learning a lot from the projects. And what I've, you know, it is so much work, but what I've really gained from it is the kind of commissions I'm getting now really suit me and what I'm passionate about. So it's really worked in that way. I feel like I'm not getting so mismatched with what I'm being commissioned. I'm being commissioned in the way that I want to shoot, which is amazing, because then you don't have to sort of put on that sort of act to try and please the magazine and fit in with their aesthetic. I feel like my aesthetic is now what I'm known for, so they wouldn't ask me unless they wanted the way I'd do it naturally.
Well, yeah, and that's a sort of fundamental skill or requirement of a good picture editor, isn't it? To match the photographer with the type of job, yeah. And that's where they show their kind of skill set, really, in a way, yeah. That they're there to.
But you've also got to be very clear that you understand your own style, right. And you know that style's got to develop until people can really read it, and that takes quite a long time, yeah. I think, or it takes quite a lot of confidence not to just be a sort of pleaser and try and please the picture editor and just do it the way you feels right for you. So that takes years, really. Well, it's taken me years, but I feel like I'm now finally on that path that I know what I want to do. I mean, hopefully it will lead to commissions, but now that I know what I want to do, I can, I don't know, it just feels right. It just feels right to work in that way.
How's the editorial market kind of feeling to you? I mean, because what, you know...
Jesus. It would be felt to those creatives, I think.
Yeah.
Fragile.
Just when you figured it all out and there's no...
I know. God, if only I had bloody got on with it a bit quicker.
It's always easy to say.
Yeah, it feels really fragile. I don't know where it's going.
What does your income pie chart look like these days? Is it still mainly editorial?
Flaky.
In terms of not just how much you're earning.
If I think about it, I just think, I don't know, where does the money come from? I just, you know, luckily, I mean, I get editorial fairly regularly, but it doesn't pay very much. But every so often, there'll be this job come up.
Commercial.
And I'll be like, thank God for that. Yeah. You know, someone's seen Hackney Studio and they want me to shoot in that way, but it's for Barclays and it's like, you know, it doesn't happen that often, but it just seems to happen just at the moment where I think, Jesus, you know, am I unemployed or is this working? And it's just, I've been on that cliff edge quite a few times, and then there'll be not a book cover, because they don't pay very much either, but there'll be some job that's just like, yeah,
saves your ass,
got me out of like, what the hell am I doing? And I do a bit more lecturing now as well, which again doesn't pay hugely, but it's like a little, like you say, with the pie chart, it's another slice.
Exactly,
it's another thing which actually I gain a lot from and I enjoy doing, but it's also, I couldn't survive just on the editorial.
No, of course.
I don't think.
It's all about having you know,
maybe I'm not pushing for it enough, though. You know, I'm not, I don't feel like I'm fighting for it in the same way I used to.
You don't hustle?
I don't at the moment. I'm just giving myself a talking to that I need to hustle more. Because I think you can sort of sit back and go, well, everyone knows what I'm doing. Because you've been doing it for so long. But actually, all those picture editors have changed and moved on, and they haven't seen you for ages, and they've got different jobs, or you've got different work to show them. So I think actually I haven't hustled for a long time, but maybe I need to put some time aside to doing that, especially now that I'm not doing the book projects, because I didn't have any time to hustle. It was like, it was either working or working on the book project. Or promote, and we take so much time to promote and market those things. It's another.
Yeah, so you've got all these different plates you're trying to keep spinning.
Exactly.
And it's where do you put your.
There hasn't been time for like setting up portfolio appointments and stuff, which I think I probably should do. But then again, you know, I've been amazed that quite a lot of picture editors, you notice they're on your Instagram, so they can see what you're doing. They can see what you're doing.
To some extent, yeah. But yeah.
More than.
There's a lot of other people
viewing
on there.
Once a year or once every couple of years. Actually, they're seeing what you're doing fairly regularly.
But also that gives you, in a way, a kind of... I think social media helps. As you say, it's kind of a very... It's a good leveller. So it kind of helps to give you an excuse, in a way, to make contact with someone. Yeah. Whereas before, it's really hard to phone someone up and go...
Yeah.
Either explicitly say, can I have a job? Or, you know, just sort of go, oh, I'm just kind of checking in. You know, it's like everyone knows.
Yeah, you feel like a complete idiot. You're just like, am I wasting their time? But no, I've literally, in my new kind of like back to school September kind of work mode, I have direct messaged a couple of picture editors who I know are following my Instagram and just gone, oh, have you got time for an appointment? They're like, great, lovely, come in. And I've almost been like, oh, why didn't I ask years ago? But that's okay. You know, It wasn't that difficult because I didn't ring them up and feel really self-conscious. It was just a little message. If they get back, they get back. If they don't, they've missed it and I don't have to worry about it.
So,
you've got to just use those tools. I mean, it used to be so hard to find picture editors and get through to them. You know, you couldn't get in unless you knew people, whereas you can ask anyone now, anything.
I wanted to ask you about that portrait that you did quite recently of the Grenfell...
Of Corin.
For people who... I guess this would have been all over the world, this story, but we had a big fire here in London. A huge tower block went up. It was pretty dramatic. So you took a portrait of one of the survivors. How did that job come about?
That was a commission for Grazia.
Grazia magazine.
Yeah. So to go and do a portrait of her 6 days after the tragedy. I mean, it was so fresh. It was just like, that's all that was on the TV, wasn't it? Just seeing that the tower was smoking for days after. It was just horrendous. So yeah, I was asked to go and do a portrait of her and her family. And it was just so shocking, a situation. I can't remember the figures, but there was just so few survivors. It was a really shocking tragedy and still is. It's still so very fresh. She texted this morning and she's still in a hotel. So it's, it's awful. But
so that's been what, three months?
Yeah. And she's got two kids and a husband. Mm. So they're in one hotel room, which I can't imagine. You know, they've gone through the most horrific ordeal anyway, but they can't even start putting their lives back together because they're in one room of a hotel. So nothing's normal and real. It must be such a weird static no man's land to live in. But 6 days on, I was asked to photograph her, and I knew it was going to be, I just felt such a responsibility as a photographer that I had to get it right, whatever that means. But I just really felt I had to kind of portray her. Well, I didn't know what she was going to, I didn't know what she looked like or what state she was going to be in, but I just felt like I was really protective of her. Her sons had woken her up to screams and smoke, and they'd gone and woken their mum up and said, what's going on? She ran them down 17 floors to get them out, and 2 minutes later the stairwell was impassable. So they'd really gone through such a crazy situation. I wasn't sure how I would photograph her and how she'd feel, and I knew, we were photographing her in the hotel she'd been temporarily put in. And it was just such a surreal experience to go to the hotel, and in the foyer while I was waiting for her, there was families on holiday, German and French families doing the tourist thing in London. And then a few sort of stragglers in the foyer with carrier bag, plastic bags. And you were like, oh, okay, they're the guys that have survived Grenfell and they're the families on holiday. And everyone in the weird purple carpet, weird hotel. It was just such a surreal situation to walk into. But anyway, yeah, we did a portrait out the back, took 10 minutes, and then she had to go and have a police interview.
I think you really nailed it. It's a great picture. Do you think that's one of the best portraits you've done?
I'm pretty proud of it, but I'm really proud of her. I think
it's very strong. She looks strong.
It's weird that you see such a reflection sometimes of what you're feeling for that person is what you're capturing. So I don't know whether I'm capturing her or whether I'm capturing my feelings of, like, she was so calm and together and strong and polite and wonderfully protective mother surrounded by absolute carnage and chaos, that maybe I have captured her, or maybe I've captured how I feel about her.
I think it's both, isn't it? I guess that's what ideally you
Yeah,
get.
Maybe that's what it is. It's a combination. But do you know what I had in my mind when I was going over there was Dana Lixenberg's photos, which had been in the photographer's gallery all summer. And I was obsessed with that exhibition. I must have gone 3 or 4 times and spent hours in front of those pictures and bought the book. I can't remember the name of the project now.
Nor can I.
Check, what's it called?
I'll put it in the notes.
Yeah. But I was so moved by those portraits. I think somehow I'd absorbed that body language of some of the women on that estate. Where was it? In Brooklyn? Anyway, you can explain it later. Faffing about. But there was such a pride and self-respect and strength in Dana's portraits. I really had them in my head.
Right.
And when I didn't know how to photograph Corinne, and I knew we only had 10 minutes, and it was like a horrible street, cars everywhere, nasty brick, nasty... You know, there was nothing picturesque going on, but I thought if I could just strip it down to just really plain and just have her, it's all about her, like Dana's pictures, which are black and white and really stark, maybe I could get something. So it's weird how I've probably only thought about that recently, but it's amazing that every image you see, when it really has an impact on you and you absorb it, you sort of take it into your own work. So I wasn't trying to copy a Dana Luxenberg, but at the same time, I couldn't not see her work.
That was just
it was already in my head. It was like, it's there. So it starts to sort of filter into your own aesthetic in a way.
Yeah, so you just found a nice white wall. It looked like
it
could have almost been a studio
background.
Raining.
I couldn't go far. And she said, I've got 10 minutes. The kids are upstairs. They're already distressed. I've got to go to a police interview. So it's like I couldn't take her anywhere. But at the same time, I couldn't do it in that foyer. She didn't want me to go up to her room.
It looked like you shot from... Were you a little bit low? Yeah, that was...
Because there was, car parking things, which I had to avoid.
Right.
So I had to get her up on the
curb.
But
that perspective
has
given it something.
Puts her on a pedestal, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And she's got such a sculptural face. She's absolutely beautiful and stoic. She's almost like one of those Russian sculptures of so chiseled her face. You know, just all those elements come together. And she was bloody strong. You know, she was like in this bubble of I will not crack. She was like, I haven't cried yet. And you could tell that she'd put up the defences. She had two young kids. She had to get through it. So she was like this larger than life. Calming, you know, she had this bubble of calm around her, but it was just protecting her. She was amazing. She's coming to the Portrait of Britain with me next Monday. They're doing a night for everyone who got their images in the exhibition and the subjects, so we're going to go together.
Oh, great. Yeah, because that was a big thing that's here in the whole country, where they've picked a whole bunch of portraits and they're going to be all on display in the public spaces, aren't they, on bus stops or wherever. So you're one of that picture can be one of those.
Yeah.
And I imagine we'll see that in the Taylor Wessing next year. You're going to put that in, right?
It got rejected.
No!
This year, yeah. I have had 10 years of rejections from Taylor Wessing. You know, for 5 years I put in different One Day Youngs, rejected every time. But Portrait Salon usually pick them up. I'm like a winner of the losers.
Yeah, I know.
Always have been.
Portrait Salon is the thing that people who don't get in get, you know, put in there. I'm astonished. I mean, you know,
and because of the story, I feel that, you know, that is such an important portrait to me. And to be in Portrait of Britain, I'm so glad that Corinne's there, because it's like you don't want that story to be forgotten. And although Portrait of Britain, there's a lot of sort of celebration of our Britishness and, you know, quirkiness and all of that, actually what's going on in Britain is all these failures as well, the failures of our government, people being
anyone who now doesn't get into Taylor Wessing can just go, well, you know what, yeah,
join me, yeah, Portrait Salon.
If that bloody picture didn't get in, then it's all bollocks. I mean, I know that, you know, these things.
Thank you, Ben.
Okay, well, look, let's wrap it up. Thank you very much for talking to me. I've enjoyed it, and good luck with everything else.
Cheers.
Thank you, Jenny.